Welcome in, everybody, to the Boston Sports Summit presented by the Grid Network. I am your host, Tim Barnard, and today we have a very interesting show for you due to the fact that both Boston teams are up 1-0 in their respective series. So it's been a good week, all right? It's been a very good week. But first, I want to start off with the Boston Bruins. I had a little bit of a special for them on Monday prior to game one, where I wanted to go over game seven, everything leading up to it, you know, my reaction to game six, you know, games five and six technically, and then my reaction to game seven. And then, of course, I was very excited to see how they were going to play in game one. And sure enough, I thought they played pretty well. The Bruins are obviously playing the Florida Panthers, and it's a heck of a series, right? It's going to be, I think, a cutthroat series, something that, you know, both teams are going to have to bring their A games for, including especially the Bruins. And Monday night, you could tell that the Panthers definitely did not have their A game. And I'll get to more of that in a minute. But first, I do want to remind everybody that I do want to remind everybody that the Bruins, you know, lost to this Panthers team. You know, they blew that 3-1 lead, which again broke a lot of our hearts because they were the best team in baseball. Did I really just say they were the best team in baseball? No, they were the best team in hockey. All-time record, points, wins, you name it. So it was really crushing for the Bruins to lose the way they did to the Panthers, who ended up making it to the Stanley Cup final. And it was something that, you know, people ask me, oh, you rooting for the Panthers after they beat you? And it's like, no. The only time I rooted for the Panthers last season was to beat Toronto. That's it. You know, I wanted them to lose the Eastern Conference Finals, and I wanted them to lose the Stanley Cup final. So there's that. But getting into game one, again, he stood on his head for Toronto basically all season, and he stood on his head in game one. He didn't necessarily steal you game one, but there were some big-time plays that he made that, again, it's his net. There is no other guy, and that was Jeremy Swayman. 45 seconds into the game, that massive save that he makes with his right leg just off the rebound. I forget who it was, had a wide open net. It was just insane. Like, I don't know if Linus, actually, I know. That would have been a goal with Linus Allmark in net. There's no way a cold Linus Allmark would have made that save 45 seconds into that game. And this, it's a massive difference, you know, still being tied 0-0 and being down 1-0 after an emotional win on Saturday night, just two nights ago. And you're riding high. You're like, we got this. 45 seconds into the game, oof, you're down 1-0, right? That was the massive difference I felt, you know, which could have happened. It didn't, thank God, but I felt like that could have happened, which is why, again, Swayman is just in the zone. There is no other guy that should be in that net, period. No other guy. Linus Allmark, I'm sorry, but, dude, your time is done. It is over. And that's the exciting thing, I think. You know, and because of Swayman's big save in that first 45 seconds, I felt like you could tell that the Bruins definitely played a bit more relaxed. They had a lot of weight off their shoulders. They weren't so uptight like they were. They weren't gripping their sticks too tight, and they took advantage of it. You know, it was a game in which, in that first period, Sergei Bobrovsky, now, here's a guy the Bruins have some history with, because Bobrovsky beat Tampa Bay in 2019 and swept them with Columbus after Tampa had their NHL record-setting season. And then Bobrovsky, we beat Columbus in four or five games. And then we had our record-setting season. The Panthers threw out Alex Lyons against us for the first three games. And then starting game four, they had Bobrovsky for the rest of the series. We got to him putting up six goals in game four, but then he beat us the rest of the series. So we have some history with this guy, and he can get got. Like, yeah, and I'm sure you've heard that plenty of times, but Sergei Bobrovsky is a guy that he can be had. So watching that first period, the game ended 0-0, and while I thought Florida was creating plenty, and I mean plenty of chances for themselves, there was multiple moments where Bobrovsky was just diving out of his goalie crease. He was moving all over the place. He seemed like he was off his edges a little bit. And I just was watching it going, we can score on this guy. I firmly believe that we were going to score on that guy tonight. No two ways about it. I'm not even talking about, you know, Ekblad's defense. I'm not talking about the rest of the Panther team. No. Just something about the way Bob was moving around, having to, you know, throw his body this way, throw his body that way. It just showed me that, I don't know, this guy doesn't seem to be 100% there. And sure enough, with the help of Aaron Ekblad, Boston was able to get on the board to tie the game off a great, great shot from Morgan Geeky. Morgan Geeky, Pavel Zacha, they were able to, you know, crash the net, and the puck just bounced right off of Bobrovsky while Bobrovsky's basically on his back. Geeky gets the puck, goes, top shelf, just ties the game up, which was crucial. Because again, Toronto goes up 1-0 in game seven in a little over a minute. Boston ties it up. Same exact thing happened on Monday night. Florida goes up 1-0, and a little over a minute later, Boston ties it up. It was definitely, I think once we tied it up, there was no denying what was going to happen the rest of that game. You know, I just felt firmly that Geeky's game-tying goal absolutely, you know, had a ripple effect on both sides. And Aaron Ekblad was absolutely the catalyst to why Boston was able to, you know, score multiple times, right? He was the one that turned the puck over on Geeky's game-tying goal. He coughed up the puck to Pasta in the first, which forced Bobrovsky to make a save where it was one-on-one. And he was also, ironically, the screen for Kahlo's goal that put the Bruins up 3-1. And so Aaron Ekblad had an awful night. You know, Bobrovsky wasn't 100% there, and he made some big saves, but clearly let up a lot. Ekblad, on the other hand, good God, you know, that poor guy. And I say poor guy as a Bruins fan, right? Like, you're watching him. He got beat. He made mental mistakes. My Panther buddy and I were going back and forth. Like, you know, he was bitching about Ekblad all night long. Like, it was wild to me, and just something that I was laughing at, because I'm like, yeah, dude, this guy sucks. Like, he just had an awful night. I felt like that whole Panther team just came out absolutely rusted. Overall, Florida had way too many mental mistakes and just gave the Bruins way too many great opportunities that Bobrovsky was able to stop some, but wasn't able to stop them all. And so the lone bright spot, I thought, for the Panthers was the fact that they did have some dangerous chances in the Bruins' own zone. They had bouts of intense pressure that the Bruins' defense and Swayman were running around a little timid, you know. And I'm not saying Swayman playing timid. No. That's not what I mean by that. But I'm just saying that there was a lot of pressure generated in the first and second period, especially for the Panthers, where it was nerve-wracking. It was nerve-wracking where you're just sitting there thinking to yourself, this 2-1 lead's not going to last. You know, the Florida's going to take go ahead one, you know, go ahead by one after the game tied up. You know, the 3-1 lead, hey, Florida's on the opportunity. They're about to cut this lead to one right before the end of the second period. Yeah, like, so stuff like that, that's where, you know, again, we have to be better. The Bruins have to be better. But it was a good game overall, I thought, from the Bees. Overall, I thought the Bruins played very well. And I'd love to hear what your thoughts are. It's funny. I've been going at this for the last 11 and a half minutes, and I have no idea where my cursor is here. And I'm not even in the there we go. I'm in the right framework now. I wonder what the heck – why was this so different? So there we go. See, you just gotta pay attention, right? But yeah, so the Bruins definitely needed to play better. Though the one guy I said this at game seven, and I said it on Monday night, Mason Lowry looks like a NHL veteran with the way he's playing. The fact that he's in his eighth career playoff game on Monday night, the dude looks like a vet with his confidence, carrying the puck, the way he just moves around, his handles, the skill in which he handles the puck. I mean, he is by far our best offensive defenseman, and it's not even close, right? Mason Lowry is the guy. There's no two ways about it. And I was pumped watching him shoot that puck to go up 2-1. And don't forget, he had that missed shot earlier in the game where Bobrovsky was in his net and somehow Lowry hit the post in the first period. And you're like, oh, that was a perfect opportunity. But I thought it was even better for him to score the way he scored, to be able to get in there and just on one leg go right above Bobrovsky's, I want to say blocker, you know, blocker arm right over the shoulder. And it was funny. Kevin Weeks did a good breakdown as to why Bobrovsky shouldn't have done that and why that's not the right move. And again, goes to my saying of, Bobrovsky wasn't in his right mind on Monday night. Like, he definitely was off. But that was a beauty of a shot, an absolute snipe. And I want to hear your take on it. You can hit me up below, like, on my X at Boss Sports Summit. You can hit me up on Instagram, Boston Sports Summit, YouTube, Boston Sports Summit. And then we're always on the Grid Network every Wednesday. Or if there's any specials that need to happen, we're going to be on the Grid Network on YouTube. So always make sure to stay tuned and check us out. But yeah, it was an absolute beauty of a shot. Loved every second of it. And there was really nothing outside of course, Ekblad, I think, you know, turning the puck over again or not being able to get the puck out of his zone. You know, that was a perfect scorer's goal, right? He just, I can't get enough of it, really. So, yeah, Lowry, he might arguably be our best defenseman right now. And it's not even because of his defensive ability. And his, I think defensive ability might need some work, or it will need some work, at least down the line. But right now, you know, with McAvoy still not playing 100%, he had that turnover again that led to the lone goal of the game for the Panthers. Again, similar to game seven. It's like, dude, like, what is going on with him? That is something I want to, you know, figure out. And again, if he's dealing with an injury, you know, props to Charlie. Like, I got no problem, you know, him fighting through an injury. You know, it just, and we'll never know, obviously, unless the Bruins get knocked out. But I do have a lot of respect for guys during this time of the year. Yeah, they're going to be playing hurt. You know, they're going to want to try to continue for as long as they can, so that way they are still on the ice, whether it's to earn a paycheck or to get that next contract, or because they love these guys and they want to be out there in the thick of things with them as long as they can be. But with Charlie, it's like, even if he's dealing with an injury, a lot of his mistakes are more mental than physical, which is why I go, dude, why is your injury affecting your mental state? If anything, you should be more conservative, more relaxed, you know, more trying to find the easy answer and not trying to make things, you know, push things when they don't need to be pushed. Right. I hope he's not dealing with an injury, and I hope it's just straight up mental errors that he could get corrected tonight, or, you know, at least by game three, you know, and be fine. Right. So McAvoy still has to play better. The other defenseman who I got to talk about, Brandon Carlo, my God, what a 48 hours for him, you know, gets the call, wins game seven, gets the call saying that his wife is going into labor. He goes to the hospital. You know, he has a kid early Monday morning. He is able to get the reprieve. See you, honey. Got to go to work. Enjoy the kid. and is able to fly down to sunny Florida, goes down, and in the day his son is born, is able to score a goal to put the Bruins up 3-1. I mean, again, dad strength right there. You love to see that type of stuff. You just know that if a guy becomes a dad for the very first time, that later that night, or if he's playing that night, that he's got this like dad energy to him. And it happens across all sports. It's so funny the way it happens. In basketball, you know, you got guys who will just have a night, you know, shooting the ball because they had a kid that day. Brandon Carlo, game number one in the second round of the Eastern Conference playoffs and the Stanley Cup playoffs, is able to score a goal. The guy scored four goals all season. Like, he doesn't score goals. And it's awesome. It's great to see. I was so like pumped. And then seeing him walk down the hallway, getting hugged by Lowry, Brad, Montgomery, you just knew something was going on right there. That he had, like, again, just like when people say that the woman has a glow about her because she's pregnant. When that kid is born, you know that guy has a glow about him. And there's this extra motivation that just runs through his veins, and you're like, bam, he's got it. So props to Brandon Carlo. You know, it was awesome. It was fun. Just another added juice, I would call it, another added bonus. But then the one other guy I absolutely just love is Pat Maroon. I said this, you know, right before the trade deadline, if there's a guy that I want, it's Pat Maroon. And like, when we traded for him, he came with the back injury, and I thought to myself, well, hopefully he can be ready in time for the playoffs. And he looked a little slow coming out of the gate, wasn't 100% sure about him in game two against the Maple Leafs. But after seeing, and don't get me wrong, I've been a big Pat Maroon guy all season. Yes, it was a little, maddening to hear the whole dust up with him and Jack Edwards, with Jack Edwards calling him fat. And because let's face it, Pat Maroon was, he entered the season fat. Like, dude, just own up to it. You didn't have to make this, you know, and again, I don't know if it was Pat necessarily or social media and everybody else being like, you can't say that. Like, really? When a guy comes in 300 pounds and he's only 6'4", sorry, kind of fat. I don't even know if Pat Maroon's 6'4", but, and I know he wasn't 300 pounds. I'm just exaggerating. Though, that was a little like, dude, really? Really? But now that he's a Bruin, you know, it's, I love the dude. Again, he's very hateable when he doesn't play for your team, but lovable when he does, because there was a video that was circulating all around Twitter Monday night and Tuesday of Maroon leaning over the bench, looking at the Panthers bench, calling them effing P words. And I think you can fill it out if, especially because it goes along with a certain animal that lives in a household. Like, how more descriptive can I get? I mean, come on. You know what he said. But it was just like the Pat Maroon factor, I feel like, is real. He is that physical presence that no one wants to mess with. And he has this way about him that obviously he won 3 straight Stanley Cups, the Blues, both Lightning teams, and went to 4 straight because the Lightning went to 3 straight. So Pat Maroon is the real deal. And I hope that the Bruins can have a long playoff run, because I would love to see the Pat Maroon factor that would carry itself the rest of the playoffs, really. So love Pat Maroon. And I do want to ask one more question from you. Can we please stop with the goaltender platooning? Is it that, like, can we please? Jeremy Swayman has now a .955 save percentage. He has been absolutely unstoppable, unbelievable. And, like, again, that's why I've been saying time and time again, we cannot have a goalie platoon. To have a goalie platoon means you're going to sit a guy like Swayman, and it's just dumb. You shouldn't do that. So that's why, for everybody who is calling, not Doug, who is calling for Ullmark to start in game one, it's Swayman's net. From here on out, it is Swayman's net. And I'm glad they did the right thing. I'm glad they stuck with Swayman in game one just to see. I was full-blown ready to say, okay, Swayman's good against Toronto, not so good against Florida. Ullmark, you get game two, and let's see how you do. No. Jeremy Swayman is the goalie for the Boston Bruins until further notice. Ullmark is going to be riding that bench for as long as the Bruins are in the playoffs. It is that simple. That, like, there is no reason for Boston to trade out goaltenders right now. Like, that is asinine to me. And that is why I was so adamant about what, like, this whole platooning thing, you know, from the get-go. It doesn't work, because if you're going to make a playoff run, you're always going to have a hot goaltender. So it's just, I'm glad. I'm glad we can finally get through this. We're done. It's Swayman's net. Allmark, you did good this regular season. Not great. You did good, but here's the bench, pal. Here's the bench until further notice. We'll let you know when we need you. So now, going from one playoff team to another, you have the Boston Celtics, who played their first game of the second round last night. And it honestly, the Celtics, yeah, the game was close for, you know, decent portion of that game. But I'll tell you, the Boston Celtics looked like the friggin' Monstars playing the Looney Tunes when the Monstars were on that run where the scoreboard was just ringing, ringing, ringing. And then, if I remember correctly, it read, you know, is the half over yet or something like that, where the Looney Tunes had no hope. That's what game one was for the Celtics. They just absolutely dominated, I thought, the Cavaliers. It was a Jaylen Brown and Derek White affair. The two of them scoring, Jaylen Brown with 32. Derek White, I think, had like 28, 27, respectively. So they were just dominating. And then the Boston bench, I thought, finished it off for them. Peyton Pritchard has really come into his own this season, and I've been really glad because I felt like Pritchard was always buried at the bottom of the depth chart, only saw a handful of minutes, not enough to really make a difference. And every time he got out there, it was kind of, you know, so-so. He wasn't the best. He missed a lot of shots. But now he's really turned himself into quite an interesting third point guard, maybe even a future backup, let alone starter on a different team. But his three to end the third at the buzzer, done. You knew it. I mean, at least I knew it. Like, how could you not see that three go in and just look at the Cavaliers' reactions and feel to yourself, oh, the Cavs can easily make a comeback. Seriously? There was no way, no way on God's green earth, at least in my opinion, that the Cavaliers were coming back after Peyton Pritchard drilled that buzzer beater three. Because in two, he's running in and he's kind of like falling forward. Like he's going off balance in a way. And yeah, just a boom, like done. Done. That's it. That's it. Game one. The Celtics wrapped it up. They easily dominated game one. And it's very interesting to me because three of the four victories that Boston had over Miami were by 20 points or more. They won this game by 20 points or more. So in six games that the Boston Celtics have played, they have won four games by 20 or more points. Like, how absurd is that? Like, it's almost too easy for them right now. And not for nothing, and don't take this the wrong way, I love a good blowout. I really do. Why? Because it's just, you get to sit back, you get to relax. It's, you know, there's really no stress in the matter, especially come playoff time. You're like, there we go. Game's over. We got this. Don't even bother. Like, you know what? Like, we're good, right? But to do it 2/3 of the time, and they have already tied a franchise record by winning four games of 20 points or more in the playoffs. That is a franchise record. And that's probably going all the way up to the NBA Finals. Like, how absurd is that? that in 66% of their games in the playoffs they play, they will win by 20 or more points. It's great because, hey, I could watch the first half for once in my life and then turn it off for the second half and turn to something else because I know how this is going to end, which is great. But at the same time, it's kind of like, yeah, really? All right. Yeah. Hey, we won. Big deal. Like, this is why I led today's show off with the Bruins and not the Celtics, even though the Celtics played last night and the Bruins played on Monday night. Because, I fully expect this record to be broken in their next victory, whether it's tomorrow night or in game three. Yeah, and I'm already predicting that they're going to win one of the next two games. But it's just amazing to me. Like, I can honestly see that the Celtics are going to have 20 or more points, 20 or more point victories in the first round of the playoffs. In the second round of the playoffs, excuse me, I'm just trying to think about everything. I can totally see the Celtics having 20 point or more victories, basically shattering the old record, and we haven't even played a single game in the Eastern Conference Final. That's absurd to me that this team is that dominant. And right now, they're doing it without Porzingis. Imagine if Porzingis was in there too. Now, I'm not saying the Celtics would have won by 40, but I am saying that it could have been a bigger margin at halftime. It could have been a bigger margin at the end of the third. And it's crazy to think that we've already tied the record one game into the second round. And as for the Cavaliers, mind you, outside of Donovan Mitchell, who do they have? Who do the Cavaliers have that can make shots and be a solid contributor to the point that they're carrying the Cavs? Because right now, Donovan Mitchell is their guy. He's the only answer to the test. But the problem is the Celtics have Jaylen Brown, Derek White, Jason Tatum, Peyton Pritchard, Drew Holiday. I mean, the list goes on, right? So it's amazing. And don't get me wrong, Peyton Pritchard is not at that elite level yet, but Peyton Pritchard is a very good player and is definitely made a statement this playoff so far. But again, with Donovan Mitchell, I look around and I go, who else do they have? I know Max Strus has been a Celtic killer in the past, but that's the past. You know, has Max Strus performed so far? No, he hasn't, at least against the Celtics. And again, we've only got one game to go off of. So the other guy that I could argue might be worth something is Evan Mobley. I mean, he did a lot of damage in the fourth. Granted, it was a lot against a lot of our backups who were not playing as hard, you could argue. But, you know, Evan Mobley underneath, is that the guy? Is that going to be the guy? It's got to be Mitchell and Mobley. Like, you know, Donovan Mitchell needs to play 40-plus a game. He does, unless, again, the Celtics are blowing them out and there's no reason to, especially at the end of the game. So, yeah, if this isn't a sweep or a five-game gentleman sweep, then the Celtics definitely got lazy and have done something wrong in order to let it go six, in order to let it go seven, you know, because that's this team right now. This team right now is on such a friggin' heater that, again, they should be riding easy into the NBA Finals. And if they don't, we got a problem and we got a story. The one thing I do want to say is I saw Steve Bopet tweet out that the Cleveland Cavaliers expect to see Kristaps Porzingis in this series. And if game one has, you know, any indication on how this series is going to go, how stupid would that be to throw a guy out there who's already the size of a twig, top to bottom? Why would you risk him not only re-aggravating his injury, but possibly having a more severe injury because you want to get him back to play the Cleveland Cavaliers? Like, are you serious? Like, no. If anything, Kristaps Porzingis should be sitting on his couch, kicking back, having a couple beers, and watching the Celtics ride their way into the NBA Finals. And if the Eastern Conference Finals gives them a little bit of a challenge and he's fully healthy by that point, then fine. Then we can bring him back and limit his usage just enough where we can get a good amount out of him and we don't have to worry about a risk of re-injury and hope that, you know, again, it'll help for the Celtics to make the NBA Finals. But yeah, there is absolutely a zero need for Porzingis to come back before the NBA Finals. I might give a little reprieve for the Eastern Conference Final, but that's it. That's it. There's no need for anything else. So next on, got to talk about the Patriots, because the Pats, not only with Tom Brady, but with what's going on in their quote-unquote GM search. I just heard that it's technically not the GM. It's the, I want to say, executive vice president of football operations that they're interviewing for, but we'll get to that in just a minute. First off, I want to talk about the Tom Brady roast, and oh my God, was that effing funny. Like, it was, I honestly felt like I was in the locker room with some of the jokes that were being thrown out there, because it had me kind of going, laughing my ass off, but also being like, oh damn, at the same time. Like, I can't believe he said that. Oh, but that was so damn funny. Like, you know, like, it was, oh God, how funny was the Tom Brady roast? And it was hilarious. It was wild. But not for nothing, it felt kind of cathartic. As a Bruin, a Patriots, a Celtics, a Red Sox fan, it felt kind of cathartic, because that was tailor-made for Boston sports fans. Like, there was no two ways about it, because a lot of the jokes with Rob, with Julian, with Randy, you know, with Bill, again, with Bill, who no one is going to understand the joke about Foxborough High except us, except Patriot fans, Boston sports fans. We know exactly what they're talking about. So it was all tailor-made for Boston sports fans, and I loved it. Ate up every second of it. And just a couple of my winners was obviously Nikki Glaser. My God, was she just effing hysterical with all the crypto and just going after Gronk the way she did. You know, me know that not real money. Like, that was that was so funny. And I thought one of the winners, and I know people want to, you know, say he wasn't a winner, he wasn't that good. I thought Bill Belichick, I don't care that his jokes may or may not have been written by him, but if they weren't, I don't care, because yes, while his delivery is not, you know, perfect, he was funny. The jokes that he had were funny. Again, opening joke going right at the Apple dynasty was hilarious. and I absolutely loved it. Randy Moss, I thought was definitely not one of the winners. I don't want to call him a loser. I just don't think that that's, you know, Randy style, and I'm cool with that. I thought, you know, the whole ring bit, you know, I thought the whole ring with the cheating, I thought was pretty funny, you know, because it, before he gets there, Spygate, after he leaves, Deflategate. Like, Tom, come on, can't we cheat? Like, I can be a good cheater. I thought that was pretty funny. But yeah, like Jeff Ross, like I didn't really care for. You know, I thought yeah, the two Bert Kreischer, what their podcast there, I can't remember what their podcast is called, but Bert Kreischer, that too wasn't funny. I thought also the guy who just went off, who gave the microphone to Dana White for 60 seconds and took the mic and just roasted everybody, just went total nuclear on everybody. That had me like nearly falling out of my chair. I was like laughing so hard, but also being like, holy crap, at the same exact time. And then as for Julian, went a little too hard on the, you know, those jokes, you know, but like it was pretty funny. And then Gronk just going completely off script, having nothing going on, just running out, ranting and raving. Like it was hilarious. Like it was a fun night. The one thing I will say though was Robert Kraft. I mean, saying that Julian's not invited was probably the lone funny thing, but he, again, as I talked about it before, he wants to have this perception of him that is, oh, look at me. Like, I am, you know, the nice guy. I bring people together. I don't fire this. Like, then to have Kevin Hart bring Kraft and Belichick up to do the toast, you could tell Bill did not want to be there. Like, that was so blatant, so evident. And I don't even think Bill drank his shot when they clinked glasses. So, again, that just goes to show you. But I thought the real story, not the real story, but I thought a story that came out of it was obviously the report that both Giselle and Aaron Hernandez's girlfriend were both, you know, in my own words, quote unquote, in my own words, butthurt over all the jokes that were made. Especially Kevin Hart saying, Tom, how did you not realize that Giselle was taking 8 karate classes a day and she was getting bruises all over her tuchus? Like, Tom, come on. So I thought that was hilarious as well. And it was all fair game, which is what I give a lot of credit to Brady on. Everything was fair game because that's the only thing you can't go after his record. You just can't. But for those two to be butthurt, I got 3 words for you. Boo, freaking who? Right? Like, spare me. And Giselle, if you don't want to be the butt of jokes, if you don't want to, you know, get made fun of for cheating on Tom with the karate instructor, then I got a little piece of advice for you. Don't cheat on Tom with the karate instructor. Okay? It's that simple. I mean, good God. Her, and of course, her PR team trying to come out and say, oh, she's trying to be a good person and trying to raise all this money for her home state in Brazil. It's dealing with all this flooding. And I'm saying that only for the fact that she's trying to be the victim here and trying to claim the victim card and saying, well, see, I do all these good things. Yeah, I had one slip up. Well, it wasn't just one, okay? It wasn't clearly just one, because then you ended up dating the guy. I don't know if he's still together with him or not, but, like, I'm sorry. You don't cheat on your husband. and think that you're Scott, you're, you know, Little Miss Innocent. Like, oh, I had my, you know, right to. No, you didn't. You cheated on your husband. And I can't say, you know, what Tom did in the background. I don't know if he had extramarital affairs, but clearly none of that has come out. So, yeah, Giselle, you're the problem. I, like, spare me on your victimhood. Spare me on that. You know, those were honestly rightfully earned. They were. And I'm glad that Tom allowed it. So it's just crazy to me, you know, that she tries to come out here and act a little Miss Innocent. Like, I did nothing wrong. Like, see, I'm a good person. Sorry. That ship sailed when you cheated on your husband. That simple. But now moving into more football-related things, because while I absolutely loved the Tom Brady roast, thought it was hilarious, can't believe it was 3 hours, but hey, it was a fun 3 hours. The Patriots, yes, as I mentioned earlier, are trying to hire a executive vice president of football operations. And, you know, it's interesting to me because they have Elliot Wolf in-house, who was the de facto GM, who made all the moves going up to free agency and draft day, sticking at three. You had reports coming out a week later saying that the Patriots, you know, other teams felt like the Patriots were too hard, you know, fast and staying at their picks. They didn't want to trade out. They were too nervous to. And that obviously raised some concerns to me. But now with this, the only reason why I bring it up is because they have to appease what is called the Rooney Rule. And if you don't know what the Rooney Rule is, it's an NFL rule that came in, I want to say in the late 80s, in the 90s, that NFL teams had to at least interview X amount of minority candidates, you know, and then they could hire whoever they wanted. And then obviously it expanded to front office positions like the general manager role, where they have to, you know, interview an X amount of minority candidates. And then again, if they want to hire one of those guys, great. If they want to hire, you know, somebody else, that's fine. But it's very interesting because I just want to – so I used to teach a class at the University of Vermont called Sport and Society, and I used to bring this up because the way – like, I've seen it, I've heard of it, and the way it's used, I think in the beginning you had a lot of guys who had the right – a lot of minority candidates who had the right to be head coaches back in the day, but no owner would ever want to give them a chance. For whatever reason, I'm not claiming they were racist, but I'm just saying for whatever reason, a lot of minority candidates who should have been head coaches never got the opportunity. And so that's why they created the rule. It was a good rule, right? I thought in the beginning it worked, but now it's become like, and not just in the last couple of years, I would argue going back to like at least a decade, you know, plus, that this rule has been out of date. It's useless now, because what it does is, I feel like a lot of teams and a lot of owners only want to interview minority candidates just to interview them, just to satisfy the rule. They already know who they're going to hire. So they're just like, okay, let's get the run game coordinator from the Niners. Let's get the defensive backs coach from the Bears. And let's get the the defensive line coach from the Texans. Let's just bring them in. But in reality, we're going to hire this guy from, you know, the Giants, right? Who just so happens to be white. Like, it's stuff like that that bothers me. You know, that's why I get so agitated when I hear the Rooney Rule, because I feel like in the beginning, it had its purpose. It served its purpose. But now it's being manipulated in a sense where those first three guys that I mentioned before the Giant guy, the first three guys that I mentioned, they're being used, basically. They're being used. They're sham interviews. They're to make the interviewee feel like they're worth something when in all actuality, they had no chance of getting the job. And now you're starting to see a lot more minority candidates for both front office and coaching start to say, no, I'm good. I don't even want to be interviewed, you know, because of the fact they know it's a sham interview. And that's my little, you know, gripe with the Rooney Rule. I think initially you had good intentions and I thought it served its purpose, but now it's manipulated in such a way that it's so far gone. The owners, the GMs, or whoever's hiring the coach in the front office, they know who they want. Like that's how it goes. And so to force these guys in, now, again, if you took the rule away, would no minority candidate be interviewed? I don't know. You know, but that's why it's very interesting to me that that's what I think the Rooney Rule is out of date. I really do think it is. But the reason why I want to bring that up is because, again, the Patriots are looking for an executive VP of football operations. They have to appease the Rooney Rule, and they have been turned down by three different guys. Turned down. And the funny part is they just started the search. Literally yesterday, they just started the search. And, you know, I was listening to Phil Perry, who was commenting on this and talking about why, you know, candidates turning the Patriots down. And he was saying that it was too much to do in the one period of time right after they let go of Bill. So in the time they were looking for Jerod Mayo, he just happened to be in-house. Oh, how convenient. In the time they were looking for Jerod Mayo, who also, by the way, it was already written in his contract that he was going to succeed Bill. They could have gone out there and looked for this guy, at least appease the friggin' rule in January. You know, hire Elliot Wolf, but appease the rule back in January. It was tailor-made. You are just looking so stupid as Patriots ownership. Like, again, too much to do in one period of time. The Washington Commanders just friggin' hired a GM and a head coach. All in one period of time. I think in the span of like 3 weeks. Like, are you serious? A lot of bad teams do that. You know, you knew. Again, all the reports from Patriots beat writers, you knew that you were going to get rid of Bill Belichick back in October. And yet, you were so unprepared that you waited until May 7th to start to look for an executive VP of football operations and probably slash GM, or at least with GM roles. Like, can you explain that to me? You had November, December, January, February, March, April. 6 months in a week. 6 months in a week to do the search, to go on, you know, these interview processes with multiple candidates, multiple minority candidates. But you didn't because, oh, it was too much to do. I can't believe I'm saying this. But I am now at this point officially out on Robert Kraft and the Kraft family. I used to think that the Kraft family was by far the best ownership in Boston. But with everything that has gone on between, you know, the firing of Bill, the Apple docuseries, to, you know, keeping Jerod Mayo, waiting until May 7th to start to look for your GM slash executive VP of football ops, just to be turned down by multiple minority candidates, you know, because they know you have to appease the friggin' Rooney Rule. Are you not unprepared? Like, it's absolutely amazing to me how disorganized this entire franchise looks. And yet you still want to say to me that Jonathan Kraft has nothing to do with football operations. I call bull. And the fact that you have Robin Glazer as a head of, you know, football ops, again, who is she? A lawyer who, you know, was able to carry a sledgehammer down the hallway to smash the videotapes for Spygate. That's her claim to fame. And good God, was that over-dramatized. And how ridiculous it is, I think, that, you know, what does she have? What qualifications does she have to be the head of football ops? And I can't remember exact title, but in, you know, high-ranking football operation executive, right? That's a better term for it. But again, it's absolute buffoonery what is going on in Foxborough. And yes, I do blame them for, you know, keeping Jerod Mayo, you know, having it written in his contract that he was going to succeed Bill after only coaching for 5 years, never earning the title of defensive coordinator. Just, you know, this, that, and the other. Like, listen, I'm excited to see what Jerod can do, but it's so dumb to me that you had all these guys. And then also, too, don't forget about the fact that the Kraft family put out there that Mike Vrabel was their number one guy. And then what do? He gets fired. They don't even bring him in for an interview. And you just, you know, go, oh, thank you, Jerod. Come here. Like, you're our new guy. It's, again, just the amount of disorganization I feel like that is going on within this franchise, and the amount of respect that I've earned for Bill Belichick to be able to run the organization, you know, as a whole the way he did. Yeah, he's a dick, at least in the building, but he kept everything together. And if you can't see that by now, then you've clearly got some blinders on. Like, I have earned a lot of respect, for Bill, watching how the Kraft family has just absolutely mismanaged this thing left and right. I feel like we're back in the Pete Carroll days. And, yeah, Pete Carroll had a winning record, but Pete Carroll also, you know, had all the draft picks from Bill Parcells. Bill Parcells built that team. Pete Carroll, you know, when Robert Kraft got his team back from Parcells and let another guy pick all the players, yeah, he sure as hell didn't know how to pick any players. It's crazy to me. Yeah, I am totally out on the Kraft family right now. I still have them above John Henry because at least they own one team and are focused on one team. But yeah, it's, you know, the Kraft family, in my opinion, has taken a massive hit in terms of, you know, how well they ran their organization. At this point, that was all Bill Belichick. 100%. And lastly, I just want to finish off with some bright news that with the Red Sox, guess what? It's Sale Day, everybody. It's Chris Sale Day. Except that he's wearing a Braves jersey tonight and he's going against Nick Pivetta. So I just wanted to bring that up. The Red Sox, I think, are third in the AL East, which I will sit here and say that is pretty big. You know, I can't believe they have gotten to third in the AL East. They're 4.5 games outside of first place at 19-17, 2 games above 500. You know, they're 0.5 game above the Rays and 2.5 above the Blue Jays. But it's, you know, again, I, as much as I am excited and love how the starting pitching is playing, it's like we're going to hit a cliff at some point. We're going to fall off a cliff. And I don't want to be Max Kellerman talking about a cliff and seeing the Tom Brady Red Sox just keep, you know, climbing and climbing and climbing and climbing and never falling. You know, I hope that's the case. I hope I become that Max Kellerman who's saying, oh, this starting pitching is not going to hold up. They're going to fall off, blah, 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 blah. But, yeah, it stinks. And the Braves are going to be coming back in, I want to say, early June. And so I hope Chris Sale pitches in one of those games for a 2-game series. So I hope he pitches in one of those games because I think it would be really nice. But, again, I know a lot of people have mixed feelings on Chris Sale because he was hurt for a very long time, missed a lot of games. But nothing beats the 2018 team. You know, he absolutely crushed it. And so, yeah, it's Chris Sale day, folks, except he's in another jersey. So I want to thank you guys for tuning in to the Boston Sports Summit presented by the Grid Network. Episode 16, Boston Dominates Game 1. You know, I am your host, Tim Barnard, and please don't forget, you can hit me up on any of my socials, Boston Sports Summit on Instagram, Boss Sports Summit, BOS Sports Summit on X, and then I am on YouTube at Boston Sports Summit, and every Wednesday, this show goes live on the Grid Network's YouTube channel, so don't forget that. And also, this show is available on all podcasting streams that you can hear. So it's on Spotify, it's on Apple. So if you can't watch it, listen to it. Thank you again so much. I am your host, Tim Barnard. Bruins are on in just about 25 minutes. So I expect you, and I know I will be watching it, game 2. Hopefully the Bruins can go up game 2, steal both on the road. That would be electric factory. And so, yeah. So we'll see what happens tonight, 7:30. Bees are on. But thank you once again. Enjoy the game, everybody. God bless. Have a great night.